Organized by the iconoclastic technology publishing house O'Reilly Media, the just-concluded Tools of Change Conference offers a staging for a classic clash of traditional publishing institutions and new technology. We will hear about the jousting on ebooks in libraries or not in libraries if Penguin gets its way, and why some in publishing prefer friction for their fiction. Welcome, everyone, to our special Friday feature in CCC's podcast series. My name is Chris Keneally, and every week, Copyright Clearance Center's Beyond the Book speaks with the editors and reporters of Publishers Weekly for a look at the news that publishers, editors, authors, agents, and librarians will talk about when they return to work on Monday. Joining me first on the show is Andrew Albanese, PW's Features Editor. Andrew, welcome back to Beyond the Book.
Hey, Chris. Great job, Friction for Fiction. That's pretty excellent.
Well, you're going to tell us what that's all about in a second, but first, give us a sense of how Tools of Change look to you.
Yeah, it's Tools of Change time. You know, I know it's the dead of winter, but I sort of love this time of year because the new year always kicks off with these big digital-focused meetings, and highlighted, of course, by the Tools of Change conference. You know, I think I'm in a special club with Tools of Change because I've attended every TOC in New York, and I've been to all of them in Frankfurt as well. And, you know, if my boss is listening, I'd be happy to go to the one in Bologna too, even though I hear Italy is drab in April and the food is terrible. But hey, I'll take one. Take one for the team and go. So another great conference this year. So, you know, why do I love Tools of Change? So, because it's still really intimate as far as conferences go for publishing. Even though it sells out every year and has gotten bigger and bigger every year, I still always get to see and talk to so many people and connect with new people and really on a deep level. And the subjects at Tools of Change always range from the very nitty-gritty tech stuff like, you know, code and conversions and standards to, you know, the broader subjects of digital publishing. And it's been fun for me to see how far that meeting's gone every year. You know, I think at this year's show, there was a real sense that the publishing business is now a digital-first game. That's been coming on, of course, every year for the, you know, since the conference started. But even if the revenues and sales don't reflect that for trade publishers, that digital is first, the investments and the plans for growth absolutely do. And on one session earlier on Wednesday, Ned May from Outsell pointed out that in 10 years' time, we were looking at a very, very different publishing industry. And some there thought that that 10-year time frame was pretty generous.
I would have to agree with them, Andrew. I think 10 years, unrecognizable. 2 years, it's going to be dramatically
changed. I think, you know, maybe 2 to 5 years, we're going to see a very, very different publishing industry. But, you know, we'll see how quickly that change actually comes on. At 10 years, I think certainly we'll be looking at a different world. So you can check out our coverage on publishersweekly.com. We've been writing it up as it's been happening. But in Monday's issue, we're definitely going to have a full report in the front of the book on Tools of Change, including the inspirational keynote by actor, director, and now digital entrepreneur LeVar Burton. There was also some great copyright panels. There were 3 of them, I think, at least. And also a number of library-themed panels, one of which I had a chance to participate in. I think there were 4 library panels this year total, and that's something else considering that they had largely been left out of the program in previous years. And I think that the library panels were probably the most newsworthy discussions given recent events.
Well, absolutely, and certainly timely to chat about is a move made by Penguin with regard to its policy on ebook lending.
That's right. So, I mean, I'm sure readers by now know that Penguin decided that it's getting out of lending ebooks in libraries. And, you know, this is a topic that's almost tailor-made for Tools of Change because it is really a classic clash of the traditional publishing institutions and new technology. And not surprisingly, there was quite a bit of criticism of Penguin's move in the hallways around TOC. At the panel that I was on that was moderated by Peter Brantley, Peter described Penguin's move is a swift kick to libraries. And frankly, you know, it is. I just returned from Seattle where I conducted a focus group with information school students at the University of Washington. And so for over 2 hours, I was sitting in the great Nancy Pearl's living room listening to some very, very bright students talk about their future in libraries. And at one point, the conversation turned to ebooks. And Nancy told an anecdote about a visit she had with the major publisher years ago before any of this ebook stuff really began. At the end of the meeting, Nancy said she spoke about the shared mission of publishers and libraries, and you know, she gushed about the reading and literacy and all of the good stuff that we talk about when we talk about books and libraries. And this executive gave Nancy one of those, "Oh, you poor thing," looks and said, "Nancy, this is a business." So I think that, for me, sort of sums up how we have to think about Penguin's move. This is business. Now, it's frustrating, of course, because here we are in 2012, after a year, last year, that was supposed to be a year of dialogue and understanding between publishers and libraries over the ebook question. But instead, things are going backwards. And, you know, while I find that a bit depressing, I'm really not all that surprised because it's a business. And if you look at things objectively, business is kind of crazy right now. Consider this. 100% of the growth in the publishing business is coming from digital. Print is declining, digital is rising fast. And yet almost all of the innovation in the ebook space is coming from outside the traditional publishing business. You know, the major ebook platforms are all being built by and throttled by the Amazons, the Barnes & Nobles, Google, Apple, Kobo, Sonys of the world. And as we've seen, these companies often have some divergent interests, shall we say, from traditional publishers, and they sure as heck have some different ideas about what the future of reading is going to look like. So the library ebook issue to me only emphasizes one thing. Well, it emphasizes many things, but the thing it emphasizes to me most is that ebooks are not just another format. Ebooks are a different business entirely. Ebooks change everything. They're changing how we read, how books are sold, or rather how they're licensed, I should say. They're changing prices. They're changing what's being sold in book form. You know, the market is being flooded with free public domain titles in ebook form, self-published works, and there's all kinds of other new players that are entering the market. Ebooks are also changing how books are acquired. They're changing royalty rates. Territories are in play. Not only does this affect what, you know, future book contracts are going to look like for these publishers, it affects, you know, how they're going to earn back the advances they've already spent on books they've signed up in, say, the last 5 years, you know, at least. So in that sense, I kind of see the denial of ebook lending as having less to do with whether or not library ebooks are eating into or adding to revenues in the short term, and much more to do with how publishers are dealing with the fear of empowering new competition for digital reading. Because the digital ebook environment right now for major publishers is a patchwork of third-party suppliers and vendors. We're in an era when all these new digital businesses are springing up, and these businesses are coming into the ebook game without the baggage of having to carry forward a legacy of business that's, you know, tied to print publishing. So I think part of the denial of ebook lending by at least, you know, five of the big six publishers is probably calculated to slow the popularity of ebooks and digital reading just enough to help them get sorted out. Just enough to help them get to a point where they can retool and compete with these new digital businesses who want to run with ebooks, and they want to run now. I mean, really, why else would we be talking about, you know, as you mentioned in your intro, the level of friction that's appropriate in the library transaction? I mean, come on, man, really? Friction? What business is really saying with a straight face, I fear that our business is just too efficient. How do I make it harder for our users? Well, you know, holding back technology like that is really not a strategy for long-term success. You know, rather it's an oh my God moment. It's a reaction to a business environment that's, you know, kind of out of your control. So that said, I think that this is going to be resolved in time. It's a little depressing where we are, but you know, time is going to make things better, I think. And I do think libraries have a lot of carrots to offer publishers, from direct sales to discovery, and the fact that libraries really are a major cog in the machine that promotes reading. But the question I have now is, if librarians are going to be frozen out of the ebook game, what kind of stick do they have to go along with that carrot? I think it's obvious at this point that there's nothing a librarian can say to a publishing executive that is going to change their minds about library ebook lending, at least not while the ebook business is in such flux.
Well, Andrew, I can see why you enjoy attending Tools of Change so much. It really gave you a lot of food for thought there. Thank you for that.
Thank you.
Now I want to turn to Rose Fox, a PW Reviews editor who blogs at John Reville and who joins us, as always, with a review of this week's reviews. Rose, welcome back.
Thank you, Chris. Always a pleasure.
And I understand we have a lot of Q&As this week.
We do. The fiction section is just full of them. We have four Q&As in fiction proper. We have a Q&A with author Jane Green about Another Piece of My Heart, which is her upcoming novel. And that tackles blended families. And she talks about the struggles of being a stepmother and how she based part of the book on her own experiences as a hopefully not so wicked stepmom. In mystery, we have a Q&A with Larry Bond regarding exit plan, in which the Iranians fake a nuclear test in hopes of luring Israel and America into starting a war. And he explains his trick for keeping his political thrillers one step ahead of the headlines. In science fiction, fantasy, and horror, we have a Q&A with Sharon Shin about her new novel, The Shape of Desire. She talks about the joys of writing a leading man who has a big secret. In this case, it's that he's a werewolf. And in poetry, we have a Q&A with Jeffrey Yang, who translated Nobel Peace Prize winner Li Jiabo's groundbreaking book of poetry, June 4th Elegies, which mourns those who died in the Tiananmen Square protests of 1989. And Yang says the poems aren't polemic, they are political in the sense that everyday life is political.
Well, you mentioned making headlines, and certainly Iran is making headlines these days. And of course, the Middle East always does that. I understand there's some appearances in reviews from there as well as the Far East.
Yes, Asia is pretty big in the reviews section. In poetry, we have Engine Empire by Kathy Park Hong, which renders a triptych of frontiers, the Old West, the New East, and the digital world, where artistic acts are often tantamount to subversion. In mystery, we review Ed Lin's One Red Bastard, which features Chinese-American NYPD cop Robert Chow. That's set in New York in 1976, and there's a lot to do with Chinese politics of the time. And in comics, we cover Jerusalem, Chronicles from the Holy City by Guy Delisle, which is translated from French by Hegel Dasher. And that's an engaging and troubling look at life in Jerusalem in 2008 and 2009.
Well, the fiction reviews this week features a debut novel from a poet, as well as the return of someone whose name will be recognizable to everybody.
Yes, we have a big review of The Book of Madness and Cures, and that's the debut novel from poet Regina O'Melveny, out with Little Brown in April. And our reviewer says it's like a lyrical composite creature, part father-daughter epistolary novel, part aristocratic diary, part adventurer's travelogue, and part compendium of allegorical diseases. I'm not even sure what that means, so that makes me want to read it.
That's a lot of parts.
And we also have a big review of Amsterdam Stories, which is a story collection originally published in Dutch in 1918 and written by Nessio, which is a pseudonym meaning in Latin, I don't know. And the author worked as an executive in a trading company, an embodiment of middle-class rectitude that his stories often mock. And we also have a couple of big reviews, Allison Hagee's Boleto, a novel about a horse and the cowboy who raises it up, and John Irving's new novel, In One Person, which is about a bisexual man coming of age in the uptight 1950s. In science fiction, fantasy, and horror, we review Roadside Picnic by Arkady and Boris Strugatsky, translated from the Russian by Olena Bormashenko. And this is a great new translation of the 1972 science fiction classic. In fact, we liked it so much that we're going to be running an interview with the translator in a few weeks, which I'm very excited about. We usually do Q&As with authors, but I don't remember the last time we did one with a translator, so I've definitely got that to look forward to. And we've also reviewed Westlake Soul by Rio Yours, which takes place entirely inside the telepathic mind of an injured surfing champion, but his parents think he's in a vegetative state and are about to pull the plug. In romance, we review Direct Strike by Lorelei Buckley. This is a pulse-pounding suspense ride with a touch of romance, starring a clairvoyant, grieving mother who's trying to solve a 50-year-old mystery and lay both literal and metaphorical ghosts to rest. And an entirely different sort of romance, we have The Art of Duke Hunting by Sophia Nash. This is a hilarious Regency romance about a cursed duke from a family where the dukes always die young in some way that has to do with ducks.
And that's not a misprint or anything. It actually has to do with ducks.
Has to do with ducks. Like, one of them chokes to death on his duck dinner, and another is shot while he's duck hunting. And there are many plays on ducks and dukes. And it opens with the latest duke on a boat called the Drake, thinking that this is it. This is, you know, he's doomed. He's going to drown.
Well, I suppose if we read that, we'll all quack up.
Oh, Oh,
yeah,
Chris.
I know. Sorry.
Chris.
What can I say? But it's
that was painful.
A hilarious Regency romance. That's I have never encountered a hilarious Regency romance before, but there's always the first time.
This could be your first.
That's right. In nonfiction, what have we got?
In nonfiction, we have Mrs. Robinson's Disgrace, The Private Diary of a Victorian Lady, and that's by Kate Summerscale, and it covers a startling adultery trial in the early years of British legal divorce. We also cover Time to Start Thinking by Edward Luce, which is a sharply written analysis of the United States in decline. Our reviewer says it's required reading for pessimists and pious optimists alike. We have a big book, Drift, The Unmooring of American Military Power by Rachel Maddow. A lot of people have been looking forward to this. But our review says it's scathing but shallow. It's an incisive look at the follies of militarism, but it needs a deeper understanding of why America has so often embraced it. More positively, we have a review of Terry Tempest Williams's new book, When Women Were Birds. When Williams's mother died, she said she was leaving her journals to her daughter, but Williams found shelves full of journals with blank pages. So she attempts to understand her mother's silence and meditate on what voice is in 54 lyrical and mesmerizing brief narratives. In the lifestyle section this week, we have The Inspired Vegan by Bryant Terry, which is a wonderful volume for mindful, socially conscious, urbane cooks. And we also have The Impatient Woman's Guide to Getting Pregnant by Jean M. Twenge, and that's a manageable, informative, and entertaining guide to getting pregnant as quickly and effortlessly as possible. So I guess the modern world really has managed to speed up everything.
I'm not even touching that one. I thought the getting pregnant part was the easy part, but apparently for some people it's not.
Apparently not.
in children's picture books, what have we got?
Yeah, so once you get pregnant and you have that child as quickly as possible, let's move right on to the books for them. In picture books, we have 10 biographical picture books featuring athletes, artists, performers, and more. We also review Laundry Day by Maury J. Manning. I love the sound of this. This is a vivid, warm-hearted picture book in which a shoeshine boy tours a 1900s immigrant neighborhood and meets people of all kinds from all over the world, each of whom gives him a little token from where they come from and tells him where they come from. And it just sounds like a very warm-hearted and wonderful book. In children's fiction, we have Dragonborn by Toby Forward. This is a beautifully written middle grade fantasy about a wizard's apprentice whose master dies unexpectedly. And that leaves the boy half-trained and directionless as other wizards fight over him. And we also have 4 middle grade fiction and nonfiction books that mark the 100th anniversary of the sinking of the Titanic. And in children's nonfiction, we have Chuck Close's Facebook, in which artist Chuck Close describes his work with candor and insight. And in children's religion, we have 6 books on the story and traditions of Passover, just in time for spring. And finally, our pick of the week this week is Lucky Bastard by S.G. Brown. That's a San Francisco noir with a twist. The P.I.'s side job is luck poaching. He steals luck from the fortunate and sells it to the desperate. And our reviewer says it succeeds as both a hard-boiled homage and a paranormal romp.
It also sounds like a pretty good business model. Rose Fox, PW Reviews editor, blogs at Genreville. Thank you for that roundup.
Oh, you're very welcome. I always feel lucky to be here.
That's right. And Andrew Albanese, PW Features Editor, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you, and thank you for the great quips today.
Well, we always have fun chatting with you both every Friday. Beyond the Book is produced by Copyright Clearance Center, a global rights broker for the world's most sought-after materials, including millions of books and ebooks, journals, newspapers, magazines, and blogs, as well as now images, movies, and television shows. You can follow Beyond the Book on Twitter, like Beyond the Book on Facebook, and subscribe to the free podcast series on iTunes or at our website, copyright.com/beyondthebook. Our engineer is Jeremy Brisky of Burst Marketing. My name is Christopher Keneally. For all of us at Copyright Clearance Center, thanks for listening to Beyond the Book.